Good morning, everybody.
Please be seated.
Our final case for today is case number 53427, Agarmon versus Rogge & Sons Construction. Mr. Bradshaw for the appellant, and who will be arguing for the respondent? Will you be splitting the argument?
Your Honor, this is Mark Ray representing Rogge & Sons. We don't know. Depends on what is being said. There's so many issues.
It's okay.
No problem.
So we'll have a surprise after you finish. Mr. Bradshaw, are you ready?
Yes.
Did you want to reserve some time on this?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay.
I'll state my name for the record, Les Bradshaw, representing Mr. Garmong. This case is about tort causes of action as well as construction defect causes of action. My first issue I'd like to discuss here today is that the lower court erred in denying the pretrial second motion to amend the complaint. The motion was denied without explanation, and under Adamson v. Balker, outright denial without any stated justifying reason is abuse of discretion. The appellant was prejudiced by this abuse of discretion. For instance, the appellant was prevented from presenting his claims a failure to disclose under a preponderance of the evidence standard allowed by the Nevada Deceptive Trade Practices
Act. Mr. Bradshaw, when was the motion to amend filed in conjunction with the trial date?
The motion to amend was filed before the end of the time set in the scheduling order by the district court for filing amendments. So it wasn't late. It was within the scheduling order.
Had the trial been set?
The trial had been set. There was an end of discovery date set farther ahead. It was filed almost approximately 2 months ahead of the end of discovery. It was filed within the scheduling order limit for filing this amendment. And there was time for further discovery. Defendants or respondents here didn't show any bad faith or dilatory tactics or any reason why it should have been denied for those reasons. And they didn't set forth any specific prejudice to them, undue prejudice that would have been accruing to them if the judge had allowed the second amended complaint. Mm-hmm. The other issue under the Nevada Deceptive Trade Practices Act was that having the motion denied, appellate was prevented from taking advantage of other special protections in the Nevada Deceptive Trade Practices Act for persons over 60, and the appellant is a person over 60, so he lost those protections. So there was the abuse of discretion was prejudicial to appellants and warrants appeal. The second issue I'd like to bring before the court is that the lower court erred in ordering appellant not to present evidence of his damages related to his tort causes of action. On two occasions, the orders limited damages that appellant could present to only those listed in NRS 40.655 for construction defects, thereby preventing appellant from presenting evidence proving damages for tort causes of action. And there were 9 tort causes of action and 6 construction defects of action when the trial started. Thus, appellant's tort claims were effectively dismissed because appellant was prevented from proving all the elements of his tort causes of action.
Wouldn't the damages in the tort cases be duplicative with your contract damages there for the doors and related construction defect?
No, there were the economic damages having to do directly with the defective doors, but we separately pleaded other torts with specific other damages. And so our point of view in this case is that the damages on the tort cases were not duplicative of the economic damages related directly to.
Could you tell me what the tort damages were that were not duplicative? What tort damages did your clients suffer?
These folks, we're contending, these folks deceived the plaintiff into buying some doors that were not suitable. They withheld specific information about the warranty, about the suitability of these doors for this climate here in this northern part of the state. They withheld information when he was buying the doors, and then after he found the defects, the respondents said, you know, there are warranties here that you should have known about. They didn't disclose those warranties and the limitations on the suitability of the doors until after he had bought the doors and paid a lot of money to actually get them installed.
Well, assuming you prevailed, assuming the judge lets you maintain those claims and prevailed, and you were arguing for damages, what would the damages be for those torts in excess of whatever your contract damages would be?
Yes, these were damages related to his having to live in this house, which was quite an expensive house, with doors that had cracks and warps in them. So those kind of damages, also the damages that we're claiming would be the time and effort that he would have to put into having supervising the replacement of the doors. It's almost like the damages were related to the you know, the inconvenience of having these doors in his house, the embarrassment of having them, and so on. Those kinds of damages.
Okay, thank you.
So we are suggesting that under Callaway and citing Stern, he is allowed to recover these kinds of damages for intentional torts that are pleaded separately from the construction defects cases. And such facts were pleaded, and all the tort claims that went to the jury were, in fact, intentional torts. Therefore, it was error for the lower court judges to have precluded evidence of damages other than those listed for construction defects. The second point on those orders, on that order, was that the order was granted without part of the order was granted without motion, and that's an abuse of discretion. The order consisted of two parts. The first part addressed the specific request set forth in the motion, that is, that damages be limited to those that are allowed by Nevada law. The second part of the order went beyond what was requested in the motion and stated that damages would be limited to only those set forth under NRS 40.655. This part of the order was not requested in the motion, and appellant had no chance to oppose that in his opposition, and there was no proposed order submitted with the motion that would put appellant on notice that that was one of the arguments that the court would address. So in specifically ordering the limitation on damages under NRS 40.655, the court went far beyond what the motion asked for. An order granted without motion is a due process violation and an abuse of discretion under Sierra Nevada state lines. And as pointed out, this prevented appellant from proving the elements of his causes of action required by the jury instructions. There was a jury instruction that specifically required appellant to prove damages in order to prevail on his tort causes of action. And naturally, he couldn't present those, and therefore, the jury found that he hadn't prevailed on his tort causes of action. The next point I'd like to make is that in addition to the denial of the appellant's second motion to amend the complaint before trial, the denial of appellant's ability to present evidence of tort damages at trial, the denial of the opportunity to amend the complaint at trial after presentation of evidence, the jury receiving at least two clearly erroneous and prejudicial jury instructions, denial of the opportunity to present his own jury instructions, and removal to defendants by improper granting of their summary judgment motions. All this cumulatively resulted in an unfair trial. These other issues are discussed in our brief, and I just don't have time to address them today. But there was one time when all the parties had a chance to lay out all their evidence and defenses before the court and for the court to rule on the proofs and evidence and legal authority set forth by the parties. This was appellant's summary judgment motion, which you will review de novo. That's our issue number one in our brief. The district court erred in denying appellant's summary judgment motion. In the summary judgment motion, the appellant factually established the torts related primarily to overt misrepresentations made to appellant about the condition of the doors, and to the fact that appellant discovered the doors were cracked and warped. Only then did respondents disclose that there were warranties and finishing instructions and other limitations that they had withheld from him when he purchased the doors, and only disclosed to him after the fact to try to convince him that the faulty doors were his fault. The district court denied the motion pursuant, contrary to NRCP 56. Appellant set out all the elements of each cause of action in the motion. He then set out 48 fully supported undisputed material facts with admissible evidence supporting the elements of each cause of action, including the torts and the construction defect. He then applied the undisputed material facts to the elements and demonstrated that he was entitled to judgment as a matter of law, both as to the torts as well as to the construction defects causes of action. NRCP 56E requires evidence presented in opposition to a motion for summary judgment to be admissible evidence, and that's the point, and not mere allegations or denials, and must set forth specific facts showing that there is a genuine issue for trial.
What would the liability on Graham Rogney be? The liability of Graham? That was a motion for summary judgment that was granted.
Yes, that was.
Why is he liable for any? What did he do?
We contend that he was a co-conspirator. We allege conspiracy against him. He used confidential information received from my client in the course of his other relationship with him as a financial advisor to steer my client, the appellant, to Rogney & Sons Construction, which was a company owned by his father. And so we believe that he unlawfully or improperly used that information as part of a conspiracy to get him to use the company owned by his father to work on the house.
What about Chad Morgan?
Chad Morgan was a person that came out to the construction site and looked over the doors after appellant complained about them. And we contend that he went back. He didn't do a proper inspection of the doors, or he withheld certain information about his inspection. At the time that he was on the property inspecting the doors, excuse me just a minute, he made representations to appellant about the conditions of the doors and the reason that the doors failed, and then went back to his other co-conspirators and was part and parcel of the response back to my client saying that he in fact was responsible for the doors because he bought doors that weren't suitable and improperly used them and that sort of thing.
You have 3 minutes and 30 seconds left. You want to reserve that for a rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve that.
Okay.
Thank you.
And further responded?
Good morning. Mark Ray for Peter Rogney. The respondents as a group would like to divide up the time. I would like to go first to discuss a couple of things, if you don't mind. First of all, the matter we just discussed about summary judgments, the statement from the appellant's lawyers that the one time the parties had to present their evidence was at the summary judgment stage. I would like to address the following issue for your consideration. Obviously, the plaintiff had another opportunity. That was the 8-day jury trial to present evidence. And there's a law in this state that says that an order denying summary judgment can be appealed after the case is over. And I would like you to consider whether the law in the state ought to be clarified that when it has moved for summary judgment and it's denied before trial on the basis that there's disputed issues of fact, I would like you to consider stating that those matters, once they are tried, if the denial is based on disputed issues of fact, those matters have been already addressed, which is followed in the Federal Circuit, Ninth Circuit, and other in the majority rule across this country, because otherwise we wouldn't even be addressing this issue, since the plaintiff had their opportunity in an 8-day trial to put on their evidence. And the jury found in the verdict, as you know, the special verdict, which is at 828 through 832 of the transcript, that there was no proof by the plaintiff sufficient to support a claim as to any of the causes of action. And I think that we ought not to have appeals based on denials where the person gets a full trial and the denial was based on disputed facts. I also wanted to point out something about the summary judgment, because the critique of the motion for summary judgment as to Graham Rogney by the plaintiff is that it was based on a transcript of Graham Rogney's deposition, which was a supplement to the original motion due to the timing of the having to file summary judgments by November 14th of 2008. and the deposition transcript wasn't available, so the motion cited to his transcript that would be made available before the hearing. The hearing was held December 8th. The transcript was made available before by a supplement. It's in the record at 689 through 714 of the appellate's appendix. But I wanted to point out something else to you. The plaintiff is arguing that my client's motion for summary judgment should not be considered because the evidence wasn't there yet. And yet, if you look in the record at appellant's appendix 335 to 336, you will find Mr. Bradshaw, on behalf of Mr. Garmong, making the argument that in support of one of his motions in limine, there are transcripts that of depositions that have been taken. He represents what's in those transcripts, and that they will be supplied to the court as a supplement to his motion before the hearings, which were held December 8th. So the exact same scenario happened to both of us. Those transcripts were in the record at the time of the hearing, and believe me, Mr. Bradshaw had his day in court December 8th in front of Judge Estes, now retired. This was his last case, and or before another judge did the trial, but Judge Estes asked the same question that Justice Cherry just asked, or maybe it was Justice Gibbons. What evidence is there as to the liability of Graham Rogney? You have, and he gave a similar response, and the judge says, how do you know any of that? Show me some evidence that Graham Rogney did any of those things. And there was nothing. And it was just exactly the same question that was asked by Judge Estes, exactly the same question. So we had an oral argument. We had the record of his deposition. I dispute and deny their claim that there was no evidence in support of Graham Rogney's motion for summary judgment. Briefly, with regards to damages, I believe the argument before you by the plaintiff is that the special verdict represents findings by the jury against the plaintiff on each of his claims for relief simply because he couldn't prove his damages. That's fallacious, because the plaintiff did put on evidence of damages for each and every one of these claims, for the claim against my client for misrepresentation and against my client for breach of fiduciary duty and against the other defendants for conspiracy and for construction defect. He did put on evidence as to the value of these doors at $28,000. It wasn't that there was no damages evidence. There was no evidence of liability. That's evident from the fact that in the record, you can see, and in his own brief, what the damages were. So how can he argue to you that the reason the jury ruled against me is because I couldn't put on evidence of damages? Yes, he did. The fact is, if you look at the record at Appellate's Appendix 270, what he wanted to put on was additional evidence of more damages, which equated to $3 million for these cracks in some of his doors. He wanted $3 million in damages, including he wanted his time as a patent lawyer at $280 an hour times 100 hours to watch someone installing these doors, and similar things like that. $3 million in damages he wanted to put on front of the jury. The judge says you're limited to the damages you're allowed by the statute of construction defect because it's the same measure of damages that would be for fraud. This was Judge Estes. And then it was renewed as a matter of the record in front of Judge Rogers. This was Judge Rogers' first jury trial coming up from Dayton Justice Court, pages 1007 through 1023 in the record. Though I have taken up more time than I could, I wish I could. I'm not doing a closing again. I apologize for taking more time than I was allowed.
Hey, please, the court. Justin Frim on behalf of the respondents, McFarland Door Manufacturing Company and Chad Morgan. Again, with limited time, I just want to try to hit some of the things that Mr. Bradshaw brought up. The first thing is on the motion to amend and the judge's denial of his motion to amend to file a second amended complaint, which would have asserted 31 additional causes of action against defendants. This motion was made a month and a half approximately before the close of discovery in the case. Obviously, defendants would have been prejudiced by the fact that there were 31 additional causes of action that were alleged against them, and leaving us only a month and a half to conduct discovery into those things. The judge did not deny the motion outright without any explanation, as Mr. Bradshaw has indicated. Your honors can look at the record. Judge Estes's order refers to papers and pleadings on file. There was oppositions to the motion to amend that were filed. Even if the court did read that order as being denied without explanation, there's case law that this court has previously issued, showing that this court can take a look at the record on its own when there's a denial of a motion to amend to determine whether or not there was undue delay in seeking an amendment. And in this particular case, the timeline of events showing the delay in seeking an amendment to assert these 31 additional causes of action was significant, and the prejudice is obvious. The motion wasn't filed until, like I mentioned, a month and a half approximately before the close of discovery, 3 months before the trial date. The plaintiff had approximately a year and a half or so before that to do it if he wanted to. Mr. Garmong testified at trial that the facts that he knew him supporting his causes of action, claims for relief against the respondents in this case, hadn't changed from the time that he filed his initial lawsuit. When he did his first motion to amend, he added a claim for constructional defect, which is the NRS Chapter 40 claim. Didn't add any other claims at that point in time, sat around, even though apparently he had the same facts that he had up until the time of trial that he presented to the jury over the course of 8 days. So it's our position, Your Honors, that there is undue delay that is established in the record, and Judge Estes was within his discretion in denying the motion to amend to file the second amended complaint.
Why were there no issues of material issues of fact in the summary judgment motions you filed with your clients?
The motion for summary judgment that I filed on behalf of Mr. Morgan, pretty clear from the facts that were developed, Mr. Morgan had almost no involvement in this. He was an employee of McFarland Door that went out and did a post-sale, post-delivery, post-installation inspection of the doors at the request of McFarland Door in response to Mr. Garmong's complaint. He had nothing to do with conspiring with any other defendant or engaging in any agreement with any other of the defendants in this case to harm or injure Mr. Garmong in any way. And that was the basis, if you look at Judge Estes's order granting summary judgment to Mr. Morgan. There was only one claim asserted against Mr. Morgan. That was for civil conspiracy. And in his order, Judge Estes found there was no evidence of an agreement between Mr. Morgan and anyone else that would sustain or allow Mr. Garmong to proceed with the civil conspiracy claim through a trial. And it's our position that even under de novo review, there's ample undisputed facts to support that summary judgment in favor of Mr. Morgan.
Thank you.
The motion in limine, Your Honors, it was properly granted in this case. Mr. Ray kind of alluded to it, but the whole purpose of that motion in limine was that there were inflated, irrelevant damages that were sought by Mr. Garmong. I mean, this case involves the transaction of a sale of doors, a certain number of doors to Mr. Garmong that was, you know, they were nice doors and everything, but it was, you know, $20-some thousand or along those lines for the total amount of the doors and finishing them and everything. Mr. Garmong indicated during discovery that he was going to seek all sorts of additional damages, damages that, in our opinion, after reading the Topaz case and the Skinner versus Brunsenbelt case involving the NRS Chapter 40 claim, that the damages he was seeking were not recoverable under that law. Hence, the motion in limine, which sought to limit Mr. Garmong, specifically under Skinner versus Brunsenbelt, that the damages that are recoverable in a construction defect case, no matter how many different types of theories that are alleged, are the damages that are set forth in NRS Chapter 40.655. As your honors are probably aware, in Nevada, otherwise, there is an economic loss doctrine or economic loss rule that would preclude economic type of damages for negligence claims. In this particular case, the damages alleged are cracking or warping in doors, allegation of property damage or personal injury outside of the cracking of the doors themselves. And without the NRS Chapter 40 claim brought by Mr. Garmong, those types of damages would not be recoverable under a tort theory. If you look at his First Amendment complaint, those are the only claims that are asserted against McFarland Door. There's civil conspiracy, there was fraud, and there was constructional defect. So absent that Chapter 40 claim, economic damages would not have been recoverable. Judge Estes properly followed the law and the Skinner versus Brunsenbelt case and limited Mr. Garmong to presenting evidence of the damages set forth in NRS Chapter 40, 40.655. Mr. Garmong presented evidence at trial. It's evident from the record. Damage to the doors themselves. He attempted to put on some evidence about his loss of use, things of that nature that are specifically set forth in that statute. And it's our position, Your Honors, that Judge Justice acted within his discretion in determining what evidence was relevant and admissible on the issue of damages. Even for argument's sake only, if he was incorrect in granting that motion, it was in the form of a harmless error. If you look at the special verdict form entered by the jury in this particular case, the jury found in favor of McFarland Door on all the claims for relief, finding no liability. Therefore, the jury never even got to the issue with damages on either the tort or the construction defect claims. Therefore, you know, even if that ruling was wrong, it's harmless error. With regard to Mr. Garmong's motion for summary judgment, I just want to hit that up last. I concur with Mr. Ray. When there has been a trial on the merits, and that's exactly what happened here, Mr. Garmong's motion for summary judgment was on the merits of all of his claims for relief, both tort and construction defect that were asserted against all the respondents in this case. Judge Estes took a look at all the information that we submitted in opposition to Mr. Garmong's motion, which included sworn deposition transcripts, verified answers to interrogatories, sworn declarations under penalty of perjury, and determined that there were issues of material fact remaining for trial. That was what the jury confirmed by its finding in favor of the respondents on the liability aspect of the claims asserted against respondents. And again, I do concur with Mr. Ray when there's been a trial on the merits. In this particular case, I think it would be inappropriate for the court to be able to have a de novo review and potentially reverse a jury's verdict on the issues, the factual issues that were tried in front of a jury, especially in this case over the course of 8 days. So we ask the court that you affirm the rulings down below. There's no basis to reverse this or remand it for any further proceedings, and the jury's verdict was correct in this case. Thank you.
If I may, Your Honors, I have one short little comment on behalf of Valley Door Works with the door shop and the transaction. I just found it very astounding that Mr. Garmong's own expert at his deposition prior to trial testified that my client did not cause any of these damages. We were the door shop. We added hinges. We put some jams around it, put some holes in it so everything would line up when you mount it into the hole for the door in the house. And his own expert said that my client had no liability whatsoever, yet he proceeded to take us to trial on this matter. And I would ask that this court look at that and maybe consider the bad faith and vexatious aspect of that. And again, it was well before trial. He had plenty of time to talk to us about dismissal or anything, but that was never on the board. We went to trial.
Did you, it's probably in here, but did you request Rule 11 sanctions from the court or attorney's fees under 18010?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so. There were post-trial motions
for what did the court do?
Fees that has not been ruled on yet, pending the appeal, I believe. So those issues are in front of the trial court, but it's not been ruled on.
So how could we rule on it here now?
Well, I think you could simply say that that kind of conduct is vexatious.
Okay.
We're not asking you I'm not asking you to award attorney's fees in this. I think you can certainly make a finding that that kind of trial tactics shouldn't be condoned and, in fact, should be sanctioned.
Okay.
But again, whether you sanction, I'm not asking that, but I would ask for that finding. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Bradshaw, you have 3 minutes and 30 seconds.
Mr. Bradshaw, I had one question, and if it takes time, I'd ask Justice Cherry to maybe consider giving you a little bit more time. But my understanding is under these cases, and it starts with Olson on the economic doctrine, and I was the only justice on the court when Olson came down. I don't know if my colleagues agree with that decision, but that creating an exception for the economic loss doctrine to allow recovery of damages for construction defects, and then Skender subsequently clarifying the damages and what you can be awarded. How would the damages that you're seeking consistent, that the judge didn't allow consistent with the case law of Olson and Skender?
Olson allows separately pleaded tort cases. It allowed a negligence cause of action. That's simply what we were doing here.
Okay.
We allege the construction defects. We allege the torts. And under Callaway and Stern and Olson, those two are not the torts and construction defects. Damages are not mutually exclusive. So we rely on Callaway, which had clear language that says that if they're separately pleaded, the torts are separately pleaded, then you can go after damages in those cases for those causes of action.
Okay.
I'd like to address the issue about the last issue that came up. Our own expert testified to something. What he testified was that he couldn't see any manufacturing processes that caused the defects. The fact is that he got defective doors under the Nevada Contract Services case. We're allowed to allege that somewhere upstream from the ultimate consumer, somewhere upstream, all the people that touch that product, somewhere in there, there was something happened to make the doors go bad, whether it was a materials failure or a manufacturing error, whatever it was. But when he got the defective product, Nevada Contract Services says, well, look, somewhere upstream somebody did something. We're not obligated under Nevada Contract Services to determine specifically which upstream handler or manufacturer or vendor or seller of that product caused that. They can sort that out amongst themselves. We only have to prove that the doors were malfunctioned, they weren't as he thought he was buying, and that that he didn't misuse the doors. So the fact that that our own expert did make a statement during trial that he couldn't see any defects resulting from the manufacturing process or the fact of putting the doors together, how Valley Doors drilled the doorknob holes and things like that, that caused the defect or the malfunction. But in fact, there was a malfunction, and under Nevada Contract Services, they all have to, you know, we can go after all those people that handled it, and we only have to prove that there was a defect.
Did you file a JMOL motion, judgment as a matter of law, during or after trial?
I did not. The other issue I'd like to address is that there were 30, and this is in the motion to amend, the second motion to amend before trial, there were 31 causes of action that we alleged there, but those were distributed amongst the defendants, and each defendant group only had to deal with six or eight new causes of action. That wasn't a burden. That wouldn't have been a burden. And they alleged that there was some kind of prejudice to them, but they never articulated that. Nobody else.
How could they complete their discovery on those additional causes of action if there's only like a month and a half left before the discovery cutoff?
No depositions had been taken yet. The paper discovery had pretty much been completed, but there had been no depositions. They could have asked for shortened discovery response times.
What proffer did you make to explain the delay in seeking to amend? I understand you were technically timely within the pretrial order,
yes.
But what was the reason for the delay in seeking amendment? Was there any showing made that the claims weren't known, they couldn't have been anticipated, that you were this far into the case before seeking it for some reason? What was the reason?
We went through a huge paper discovery process during the early and mid parts of 07. We finished that paper discovery about maybe middle of August. So between the middle of August or late August, when we received all that paper discovery, assimilated it, we filed our motion to amend within about 4 weeks of that. So there wasn't any real delay. We learned some new things during discovery, which refined and prompted some new thinking. So it was that kind of thing. If there was a problem with amending the complaint that late, that could have been intended by the district court in putting out its scheduling order. Could have left some additional time there. I see my time is up.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel that participated in this matter for their arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted, and this panel is in recess until the